Good afternoon. This is the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, Friday, February 9th. Mr. McSpadden, would you please review the agenda for us?
Certainly, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. We have about a 90-minute session planned today from 3 to 4:30. May or may not need that entire amount of time, but our first order of business is the adoption of committee rules. We'll then have a three-part informational meeting. The Office of State CIO has a variety of topics. The Enterprise Information Resources Management Strategy, that is a statutory, that's a strategy required by statute. They're here today to update the committee on their progress on that document. Then the second topic involves the statewide broadband initiative. And the third topic is an update on the implementation of Senate Bill 90, the information security unification, and also the planning process for the Cybersecurity Center of Excellence.
Thank you. Is there a motion to adopt the rules?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the rules as presented.
Thank you.
Second.
Any discussion, objections? Motion passes. We have committee rules adopted. We can meet now. I'm opening the informational meeting with the Office of the State Chief Information Officer.
Great. So if Dr. Pettit could come forward along with Jennifer Bjerke from the Office of the State CIO to give us an update on the Enterprise Information Resources Management Strategy. If you could remember to introduce yourself for the record, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bjerke, and I'm the Director from the Strategic Technology Office, Office of the State CIO. Anything you want to say? Okay. Good afternoon. We wanted to take just a couple of minutes this afternoon to actually, we're pleased to present the final draft, I guess, copy of the Enterprise Information Resource Management Strategy. You are the first group of folks to officially receive the plan now that it is done. We've been working on it for, I would say, probably 8 or 9 months. I am pleased to present on the behalf of my peers. This is something that I think is, as Mr. McSpadden had mentioned, it is required by statute. It is something that we've been taking fairly seriously, but I want to talk with you today about some of the changes that we've made. Back in 2015, Dr. Pettit had actually presented an ERM at that time, not long after he had come to the state of Oregon. And at that point in time, his authority in our program looked very, very different than it did today. Not long after his arrival, we had the passage of 3099. We had the passage of Senate Bill 90. In between the occurrence of those two pieces of legislation, he became responsible for the Oregon State Data Center or Enterprise Technology Services. None of those things were reflected in the ERMS for 2015. That was actually put together as a five-year plan. And not long after the rest of those changes had happened, we realized that it was in large part no longer applicable. In 2017, you might remember that the portfolio managers for the Governor's six policy areas came before this committee during session and presented information resource management strategies on behalf of their policy areas. The new document that we're submitting you to you today is consistent with some of the strategies that were outlined in those documents, but it is really a refactoring of the book of business of the Office of the State CIO. So this is very different than looking than 2015. We have edited it, and with your acceptance, would like to propose it as the 1722 ERMS. That's significant because the 2015 plan was actually supposed to go through 2020. So if you're okay with that, we'd like to refactor the dates and move from there. This slide is actually just an overview of our mission, vision, and values. I'm not going to go into it in complete detail. It is really the beginning of the ERMS. You should have a copy of it with your committee materials. It's approximately 35 pages in length, and we're not going to go into great detail today. I'd just like to make you aware that for the first time, I think we're publishing a mission, vision, and values, and we're going to talk about some of the goals associated with this plan today and then some of the objectives that we are working on. Goal number one, information resource management. This is something that I believe you've heard a little bit about in the past. I'm going to talk most specifically about objective number one, IT governance. It's my understanding that during the December legislative days, the governor's office and the chief operating officer appeared before this committee to give you an update on their work with regard to the IT assessment from the governor's office from late 2016. One of the principal things that was brought up in that IT assessment was the need to mature IT governance. That has made its way into our strategic plan. It is objective number one under IT resource management. And I'm actually happy to report today that we've made measurable progress on this objective. We are probably at about 85 to 95% complete with respect to the action items that you saw coming out of that governor's office IT assessment. We've been working very, very closely with the Enterprise IT Governance Committee on not only rechartering their duties, but the method and manner which the state is going to move forward in terms of prioritizing the major IT projects. Just one component of that IT governance strategy. The next goal that I'd like to talk very, very briefly about is IT supply chain management. One of my peers is actually up behind me to talk a little bit more specifically about Oregon fiber and broadband, so I'm not going to go into great detail on that. I would like to talk a little bit about Basecamp. I know in the past some of you have had questions about how we are leveraging our strategic sourcing capabilities. One of the things that I'm pleased to present today on behalf of the Enterprise Shared Services Program is that group of folks has been working very, very diligently with our partners in procurement, the DAS Procurement Office. There are nearly six master services or statewide price agreements that have actually neared completion, and we've got three more behind them. So that will be, I think, a relatively positive addition in terms of supply chain management and the ability to give not only to local but other state government partners. So those are some of our contracts in place. We can talk more about those in depth later if you would like to. My understanding is Mr. McSpadden, I think, is inviting them to come talk about their program in the next couple of weeks. So I won't go into detail unless you would like me to do so. Data utility. This one is relatively new in terms of the amount of work that we've spent. These are a couple of areas that have come out of the 2017 session. I know Mr. McSpadden is very familiar with House Bill 2906, the Oregon Geographic Information Council. There's been a lot of work that's been done with Cy Smith and that program, really reaching out to the locals and making, I think, a concerted effort to bring together some of those data sets. So that is something that we're going to continue to focus on. That is progressing, I think, rather nicely. And I don't know if anybody would like to, Mr. McSpadden, if you'd like to add anything to that later, but one of the things that we are addressing under data utility. The other piece that I'd like to call to your attention, open data, data strategy, and data analytics. Those are things that are on our radar. We actually, out of statute legislative action in the 2017 session, had the opportunity to be afforded the position of a chief data officer. That is actually somebody that we are going to be hiring July 1 of 2018. So the body of work hasn't particularly commenced yet because we haven't the authority to hire the person that's going to be responsible for this particular program. So these pieces of work are a little bit behind some of the others. Information security. Another one of our main goals. I'm not going to have a lot to say about this today, as again, one of my peers is sitting in the audience behind me waiting to give you some information updates in these particular areas. So if everybody's okay with that, I will move on, but wanted to definitely call out that it is one of our very important goals tied to this strategy with some fairly significant objectives tied to it. Last but not least, goal number five, principally in conjunction with Enterprise Technology Services, is capacity management. would like to acknowledge that the work around the SDC Power Initiative continues. My understanding is that we're in the middle of working through some contractual issues. So the physical build on that has not commenced yet, but we're waiting on execution of contracts again with our partners with DAS Procurement. Cloud service enablement is something that's just recently really gotten off the ground for us. One of the things that I'd like to call to attention in terms of this objective, our ability to secure the statewide price agreement for Office 365 and some contracts that we've recently put in place in terms of leveraging cloud hosting services. Example would be services through Microsoft Azure. So those are the two things that we are working with our partners in both the Basecamp program and DAS Procurement. And that is all I actually have in terms of overviews and the goals or objectives. I'm happy to take questions. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to delve into the document itself. It is rather lengthy, but that's your high-level overview, and I thank you for the opportunity to submit it and for your consideration.
Thank you. I was just chatting a side conversation with Mr. McSpadden that we will talk with you about whether it's advisable or necessary to officially accept a take action to accept your report, which makes it a bit more like adopting something. Mm-hmm. Not quite sure whether that's something we should do, but Mr. McSpadden will be looking into that, and we can certainly figure out how to put it on an agenda as an action item.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just have a couple of questions. So first, I did notice the length of those documents. I was going to make a joke about short session and appropriateness of the length of those documents there, but I'll just not do that. But anyway, a couple of things. So in the concept of data utility and open data, one of the things, I'll throw it out as a suggestion that may or may not be appropriate, but as one of the StageGate documents is to have a transparency plan or a data sharing plan or whatever. So kind of two segments of that. One is that agencies can plan to share data with other agencies on a StageGate project, and then the other one is to share it with the public. So that would be just one thing that I would like to see. And you can comment on that, either one of you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Nathanson, thank you for the observation. Yes, this is something that's important to us, is to get out there, especially those things that are both the artifacts, the business plans, as well as the projects that are going on. There are some, what's the number right now of projects that are in the PPM tool?
96 major IT projects.
96 major IT projects right now going on, which is a far cry from the 18 that I started with going on, you know. So there's certainly a higher degree of transparency and a greater degree of rigor that I would offer. And I would certainly like to be able to open that up. It really is we're going through a transformation process right now of the project management process, and in particular we're starting to, as part of the governance work that Jennifer had mentioned, we're going through a process of figuring out how to rank order projects, you know, how to do prioritizations of projects. And so that's one of those things where just now we're just in the very embryonic stages of doing that, and working with the enterprise leadership team, as well as working with the governor's office, to be able to put together some kind of an order to the things that are going on. Instead of heretofore, it's been whatever comes in, this is what we track, and this is where it's at. Really trying to structure more of the what's important and what directly, not that anything is unimportant, but some of the things are of higher priority to us for a variety of reasons than others. And what that will eventually look like, I don't know. I only say that to say that this is an evolving concept for us, and it directly impacts this project and portfolio management tool.
Good. So, can I follow? So I'm not quite sure that you understood my question. So I'm pleased with the transparency of your agency or your slice of the DAS agency, or however we're looking at it. What I was talking about is that when agencies do StageGate projects, that the data that they create is there's a plan and hopefully I'm suggesting a stage gate document, but to share that agency data with other agencies and with the public. So that's more kind of what I was talking about. But I'm happy that you spoke on what you spoke on. That was good to hear too. So.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Nearman, members of the committee, I'll do my best to answer my understanding of your question. There certainly is an opportunity as agencies are bringing major IT projects to our office, and those projects are going through the stage gate process for us to analyze whether or not there are information sharing systems or information system sharing opportunities. We kind of refer to those as shared services. We tend to look at those opportunities before we even initiate a project. So you're talking about sharing data. We actually take a step backwards and look at, is there an opportunity for that information system to benefit multiple agencies and or benefit the enterprise? Mm-hmm. So in the end, it is about the data, but we tend to take a more holistic look before we even initiate a project. That said, not naive to suggest that there are projects that are initiated and move into execution and into implementation and somebody realizes that somebody got missed. And whether that means that you then make the information system available after implementation or the data that becomes available through that information is of value, then we would certainly take a look at and make recommendations for data sharing agreements. There's been some measured success in the past with memos of understanding around data, but at the end of the day, I think we can do a better job recognizing those things up front and understanding that it's the state of Oregon's data, and if it's mutually beneficial to other agencies, we should make that happen.
Good, and to the public. So
yeah. Absolutely,
yeah,
sure.
Good. I think you're headed in the right direction, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, as Ms. Bjerke indicated, we do plan to bring at least a written report, if not an in-person presentation, forward on the implementation of House Bill 2906. The Oregon Geographic Information Council has been formed. All of the members have been appointed. The first meeting has occurred, and they are beginning to a chair and vice chair has been selected, and they're beginning to develop a plan to implement the core components of the law and kind of get organized. So we're very happy about that, you'll hear more about that likely on February 23rd. Just one point, Dr. Pettit indicated that the office is in the nascent stages of a project prioritization methodology. That will most likely be executed through the budget instructions. You may or may not know, it's strange to say, but the 2019-21 budget development process has already begun. In March, budget instructions will be distributed electronically to the agencies of state government. They'll have a couple of months to put together their proposals, and then there'll be a vetting process within the chief financial office and the governor's office, and that'll be kind of the start of this this new method. So we'll get a chance to work together as the budget documents kind of move from stage to stage over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's move on to the next section.
Thank you.
All right, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, our next topic focuses on statewide broadband. And Melody, if you could make sure to introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, certainly. Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melody Riley Rouse. I'm the Chief Technology Officer out of the Office of the State CIO. I'm here today to present the three initiatives to broadband within our office. The Oregon Fiber Partnership, which is an intergovernmental agreement with Oregon State University and several of the other higher education departments. House Bill 4023, we'll speak about that. We'll speak about that in more detail. Amendments dash 3 and 4, as well as the Broadband Master Price Agreement. All right, so before I review the initiatives, I want to share some data that we've gathered that highlights the country, the counties in Oregon with the greatest digital divide. So the higher the digital divide number, the greater the divide that we have. And interesting fact, we were able to get information from the 2010-2017 census data. Those highest digital divide counties also appear to be depopulating over the last 7 years. Additionally, we've collected data from Department of Education as well as the Education Superhighway. What we've seen in those high in the ranking for our schools is actually affordability between 2016 and 2017 have actually decreased. So it's more expensive for broadband for our schools over the last year. So here's a look at the state of Oregon from the state agency's perspective. Here is on the picture on the right, the left, is the state of Oregon's network. Our current wide area network is limited to the I-5 corridor, which we spend approximately $14 million per biennium on. That includes leasing fiber, staff, equipment, and maintenance of our current wide area network. That $14 million does not include the last mile charges or those connections to that to those offices. With the last mile circuits added in, that averages to about $1,000 per circuit per month. Then the map on the right shows you the range we spend on those circuits. So what you'll see is those circles that are a little larger, we actually spend more on those circuits across the state. So you can see we too in the state of Oregon experience the effect of that digital divide, particularly in the eastern counties.
But before you move off that slide, as a comparison point, in Oklahoma, we spent $100 per circuit per month. So we're spending $1,000 a circuit a month here, and we spend $100 a circuit a month in Oklahoma.
Thank you for making that point. Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair. So you have your work cut out for you.
Madam Chair, Senator DeBoer, thank you for the observation.
And could you also help us understand the circles in the map on the right? It's not the case that all the large circles are east of the mountains and all the small ones are on the west side. Help us understand what's driving this difference.
Certainly. Thank you for the question, Representative Nathan. So the circles that you'll see, you certainly do see some on the western side of the state that's larger as well. So we do have larger spend in some of those circuits as well. But our rural areas, the places that are harder to get to, that are farther off of our core network, actually contribute to us paying a larger amount per bandwidth for those circuits. I'll actually go to the next slide and show you this same thing, just in a different graph. And so the bar chart shows you we do spend, certainly in agencies like DHS and OHA, they make up about half of the circuits, so we have a lot of them across the state. We spend a lot of money on them, but for things like Oregon Parks and Rec, Oregon Department of Forestry, where they are geographically disseminated in more rural areas, they're paying a lot more for those circuits because they're so much more remote and harder to get to. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Off that just quite yet.
Okay.
So I think this is very informative. I mean, it's complicated. There's a lot of numbers on here, and you see the scales and such. But I think what's really important to note is how it's really those middle circuits that it's not, even though the largest, the agency with the largest budget is ODOT, you know, clearly, that and they have a high cost. The ones with the highest cost don't necessarily have, you know, like Oregon Parks and Rec. They do not have, it's because of how remote their locations are and consequently how much they have to pay for those circuits. So I think that kind of maps to that kind of goes to those bubbles that we saw before in the previous map of Oregon there too. So I just wanted to be sure that, and then one of the ones I was surprised by out there, of course, is the Department of Revenue.
It looks like an anomaly over there.
It is not, actually. It's because of how they have many of their services are out in areas that there are So to your previous point, they're not all, it's not all just Eastern versus Western Oregon. It is the coast as well. We see a lot of this. So.
So here's a view of our current connections. Those are represented in the diamonds that combines the state of Oregon as well as higher education. We did also overlay the schools of Oregon on this same map, partly to look at the correlation, the relationship of where our sites were versus the school sites are.
K-12.
And those are the K-12 schools. So while we've listed those Oregon schools, K-12, on the map, we cannot provide service to them. So we wanted to look at the need in those areas, but currently, by statute, we are prohibited from delivering service to those state schools. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the House Bill 4023 amendments. So back in November, oops, yes, you have a question?
Oh, yes, Senator Linthicum.
Yes. I'm sorry, you've already moved away. Back up one slide.
Right there.
And, In this count by zip code, these are actually school counts or district counts?
Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. So these are actually what we did is by the different counties we looked at our circuits. So we looked at the state of Oregon circuits as well as the higher ed circuit. So that's actually the bar chart. We didn't combine the schools in that particular chart.
Circuit count.
So the chart is circuit count, and then the dots represent actually school locations, physical locations of a school, and then including higher ed and whatnot. And then I'm curious how to identify circuits in this map.
Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. So the circuits, the combined circuits between the state of Oregon plus higher education, because we're in partnership with them, those are represented all by the diamonds.
Okay.
And then the dots are all the schools that are listed.
Okay. It would be interesting to see what the mix of student population looks like, you know, in this same arena. Counting circuits is one thing. Counting student bodies is you know, the real thrust, because those are the people we're trying to serve.
Absolutely. Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. Yes, we do have school count information. In fact, the number of students per school does contribute to information that the Department of Ed and the Education Superhighway has. Their target is 1 megabit per second per user in those schools. So they're targeting that amount. The graph that I showed earlier, or the information I shared earlier in the Education Superhighway, and in fact, this next slide right here, that shows our Oregon fiber map. What we also did is we took information from the Department of Education of the schools in need. So these are the schools that don't even provide 100 kilobits per second to their users or to their students. And so these are schools in need. So of those, we applied those on top of this map, partly to show you the relationship of those schools in need with respect to our fiber routes that we have invested in this partnership with Oregon State University. There are 7 schools that are schools in need that actually are within the 1 to 5 mile radius of that fiber, which actually makes getting service out to them very technically feasible. However, we are statutorily unable to deliver those services.
Would you like, Madam Chair, Senator Linthicum, would you like a decomposition of these schools by student, by we can provide that breakdown for you if you would like that.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not going to be using it for decision making,
okay,
but it just helps, you know, kind of categorize and formulate the
sure,
contextualize the information that you're providing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have value for the real numbers, but pictures are worth 1,000 words. And if I could recommend, if you would head straight east from Klamath County there, head towards Lakeview and lay some fiber in that area, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so in November 2017, we signed an intergovernmental agreement with Oregon State University. We refer to that as the Oregon Fiber Partnership, which not only includes Oregon State University and ourselves, but University of Oregon, Oregon Health Sciences University, and Portland State University. Our focus on that was efficient government, better access for the money that we were contributing already and we were paying in to our network expenditures for our state agencies and our partners with higher education. We purchased IRUs, or indefeasible rights units, from pre-existing fiber builds. So these were already fiber that were buried and existed that vendors had implemented. We're planning on lighting up about 2,200 miles of that fiber across the state. That's represented in those red lines that you see on the map. So instead of leasing the fiber that we do currently every biennium, we have now access to those strands of fiber, and we've purchased those.
Through a competitively bid process.
Yes. All right, so the first graph shows you our cost analysis from our as-is spend, that $14 million that we mentioned earlier, as compared to our Oregon Fiber Partnership and our core network. So you'll see over a 20-year period of time, we do definitely intend on having more cost efficiency savings from that, as opposed to having continued to lease that fiber as we had planned. The next graph, the second graph over.
I'm sorry, about a 2-to-1 return on investment.
The second graph shows you the breakdown of our yearly last mile costs as compared to our projected core costs. So you'll see that relationship. We're looking at these major groupings, the north, south, coast, and east, west, so that we can begin planning our cutover into that new fiber. So we'll have those chunked out between the first grouping and second grouping and third. So based on the number of circuits, so you see about 60% of our total circuits fall into that north-south or that I-5 corridor, which is really no surprise. So we'll be focused, without any changes, we're going to be focused on those state agencies with the greatest number of circuits. As you can see from the bar chart, we spend $186,000 a month north-south and about 53 megabits per month as well, but what you'll see, and that's the monthly charge. And then what you'll see, though, in comparison is our east-west averages are 170 per megs in the east-west. So you can kind of start seeing how the north-south does compare with east-west. We do see some of that also in the coast, but again, we definitely see that more in the east-west regions.
So our all things given, we have 160 some odd sites that are state facilities that we're going to cut across to this fiber. Our focus right now and the way that we went into this was on return on investment, making the state more efficient. That primarily means those things along the I-5 corridor. Right now we're paying $53 per meg at the moment. That's what I spent on it per month. You know, going up and down our fiber, our goal is to get it to $1 a meg a month. That's what we're trying to shoot for right now. That was what we had in my previous life. But that is an exclusive focus on just state agencies, DMV facilities, DHS facilities, state police facilities, and so on.
Yes, sir.
And your dollar a month goal, what's the timeline for that projection? You know, where are you shooting for?
So right now, Madam Chair, Senator Lithicum, thank you for the question. Right now, we're looking at getting the we're trying to set what we call our scope boundary for this project. And so we anticipate once we get that set, we're going to outline what are we going to do first and to where. We've looked at the I-5 corridor particularly hard because that's where we got most of the stuff. I figure it would take about 18 months to to 18 months or so for me to swing those across. You know, give, I want to time it when circuits come due, so I'm not going to force anything to, and then I'm going to look at those circuits that I've got a small penalty on that I'm going to, for discoing early, so I'm just going to go through, it's just a math problem. I'm just going to start swinging them across as I can. So 18 months, I figure, okay. You know.
All right. So between now and June, we'll be working on our Oregon Fiber with our Oregon Fiber partners on the final design and prioritization of lighting up that 2,200 miles of fiber over the next 3 to 5 years. This is an illustration of what it would look like as we establish the POPs, or the points of presence, also, or hubs, if you will, across the state to service our state agencies. But this is also where we want to share some context behind our two amendments, and that's to House Bill 4023. We are currently, as I mentioned before, we are currently prohibited from extending out our network to our schools or other government entities, even though we know they're in need, and even though we are crossing right over them. As you can see, we're calling those glass over communities or schools, so it's like a highway, freeway that just passes right through, but we don't have an off-ramp to get that to them. So if we don't have a state agency, there, we'll just pass right on through that town.
So, Madam Chair, in Oklahoma, we used to be referred to as flyover communities. So we kind of, so I adopted that to glass over communities. I thought that would be a good
So analogy. The local police department and the local high school are just out of luck right now.
And the libraries and the and the community centers and so on. Yes, ma'am.
Including the tribes and all that.
And the tribes. Yes, ma'am.
So as we pass right by those schools, like I mentioned earlier before, we have at least 7 of those schools, which we know for sure, based on our fiber routes, that will pass right on through and not be able to extend service. And those are schools in need, not just schools. There's actually a whole bunch more schools that we have fiber that will be going through their areas, but 7 schools that we know who are actually in need. One thing I also want to point out, we also show some of the other pain points. One thing that we learned about is through the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, there was a rural broadband fund that had about $500,000 available. There were $4 million worth of ask for broadband requests. Some of that was for planning for broadband, some of that was for infrastructure. So there's certainly not $4 million to go around, but the other thing that we're seeing is that we potentially could optimize investments, and what we're seeing right now is with a lot of duplication of investments across our state, just across various sectors, state government, cities, counties, and schools are now all asking for monies to be able to connect their sites, and we lack that mutual awareness, and we don't have mutual planning to invest in our network as a whole state.
So if I may, as we optimize the network, currently, as we show the DHS, Department of Transportation, Forestry, and State Parks in say, an area, instead of doing those circuit by circuit, as we go through our engineering design, if there's a cluster of those in Medford, we're just going to go out and, you know, daisy, you know, bing, 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 daisy chain them together. You know, I'll just go out and do them as a loop because it saves me money in it. Provides redundancy, dual paths for both of them. So it's a better circuit at a cheaper price. You can't beat that. Well, fundamentally, as we said, that we're not optimizing the build for anybody else. This is just for the state agencies.
So the two amendments to House Bill 4023 that we're referring to, on the slide you'll see it says 1 and 2. They're actually amendments -3 and -4. In our current instantiation and our current statute, we will be focused on the Oregon Fiber Partners and the state of Oregon to light up our fiber and establish POPs or points of presence across the state. So Amendment 3 would allow us to extend services to schools, local government, and tribes. Amendment 4 would allow us to enter into public-private partnerships. So if there are other entities that have a shared interest where there's fiber that doesn't currently exist, that we could enter into a partnership with them, thereby extending out our network from what we have today. We also want to be really clear that the state has no intent on providing fiber to the premises. We have a master broadband price agreement request for proposals that was actually posted on February 2nd, where we intend on getting vendors to provide those last mile services as well as contract vehicles for layers 1 through 3 and other network services. That contract, once awarded, will be available to our ORCAP members. That's the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program. So that actually would allow a procurement vehicle for schools to use. So they can still use that to procure their own service.
I would like to interrupt here to make sure I understand something that I think I do, but I would like you to explain to us how the proposal to enable local governments and schools and tribes to join in on this effort, the extent to which it does or does not cost the state anything or put any additional risk on the state. Is this the kind of situation where we can do a big favor for our partners in providing services to Oregonians, but without necessarily saying there's winners and losers and one side pays the whole bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. The direct answer is neither of these amendments have any fiscal associated with them. We would be looking to E-rate. We would be looking to, for anything that was a purpose-built connection for a municipality or a library or a school or something, E-rate would pay for the build to that school. Where there was a presentation in the House Committee of Economic Development, I think it was
Wednesday.
Seems longer than that, that where they went through and talked about how E-rate has been used and could be used more aggressively by the state of Oregon to pay for those types of links. Now, their estimate was very, very high because they cannot tie to this fiber. And so that was one of the reasons that proposal came in, and that is Amendment 1. It's either 1 or 2 on this same bill, and so they're asking for a fund to be set up. That money would be for the schools to use to connect up to match with the E-rate fund. So the direct answer is to allow them, however, especially for those that were within a mile of. I mean, there are some schools that literally their property touches the right-of-way. I need a ditch witch and a handhold. That's all I need to hook them up. And as far as risk is concerned, because they're on what's called an MPLS network, they would be separate. Their light signals would be completely separate from the light signals of the state. There would not be any. There's no way for those to be confluted or in any way interfere with what the state's doing or vice versa.
To me, it seems like the bottom line is we can do something that would be of great benefit to our local government, school, and tribal partners without additional risk and cost.
Yes, ma'am. That's how I would sum it.
If I were the local governments and the others, I'd sure want to be able to see this happen sooner rather than later. I'm going to have someone explain to me why they wouldn't want to encourage us to do this. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Or maybe some discussion about how much cost to trunk into these schools and local communities. I mean, we're all in the same boat. We work together. So any suggestions you might have how to improve that, and then options for them to actually have an easy way to pay to hook up. And I think it's well worth looking while we're in the ground and we're doing it and we're going by them is how do we partner mm-hmm. with ourselves, really, because all those communities are the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Boer, that's really essentially what we're asking for clarification with this bill. I know this is not what this committee is here to hear today, but what we've asked is for clarification, what is my system boundary? Do we simply focus on those entities that are state agencies, the 640? Because that is quite a bit to chew, and if that's where we are, then that's where we are. Do we include the schools and tribes and local governments? Do we include the other anchor institutions like hospitals and local small, you know, the carrier providers that don't have access to it today to distribute to their folks? So that's really what we're asking is, what's my system boundary for this project? And we bought the fiber. We're right on the cusp of coming up with a detailed engineering design and project plan for execution. We'll begin that really in March. And so that's why this is so important to us now to get this defined.
Senator Linthicum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been decades since I've dabbled in this kind of world, but if I remember correctly, the ILECs were the guys pre-96.
Yep. Yes, sir.
And so they're the kind of copper Conestoga wagon, if you will, and the CLECs are the competitive guys hitchhiking on the wagon. But when that bubble you have over there on the far right, when the ILECs start laying fiber everywhere, there's nothing left for the competitors to kind of, if you will, hitchhike along with. Do they drop out of the system, and aren't we planning or focusing on using that competitive smaller environment to get throughput to all of these little schools and communities that are spread all over Eastern Oregon and whatnot? Help cash that out for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. The direct answer is yes, we still intend to use. The last mile providers may be using RG58U, like for cable television connection. They may be local power co-ops, so they may be able to run it through the power lines. Like my daughter has a device that runs the internet through all of our power lines in the house. You know, yeah. They could do it through the. They may have just telephone wire that, you know, that they've run, and so it would be some kind of DSL connection or something better, or an Ethernet connection. It could be wireless. You know, some communities have gone completely wireless. So what we view this as is, we would actually be potentially opening, particularly in the smaller communities, the opportunity for a CLEC to establish themselves so that they could compete with somebody else that had an infrastructure, or to, as I say, with power co-ops, somebody that otherwise wouldn't be able to compete otherwise, but they have the signal now that they could use to run across the 110 or 220 across the pole, and then 110 down to the, you know, so they could, you know, 440 to 220 to 110. So they could do it across, you know, just a device just out of your home wiring if they wanted to in some cases. So the long story short is our hope is that we would continue to partner with and have the last mile providers provide the last mile. Our intention is not to overbuild somebody else's infrastructure or to try to replace it in any way. We simply want to bring the connection to the communities that currently just do not have it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. I heard you say that you're looking for some direction. So as a director, I'd like you to give us recommendations of what you think makes financial sense. And I do think that we're looking at the whole state. I mean, the cities, they're all part of the state. So I'd like you to be aggressive and tell us what you need and what you think we should do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, as Dr. Pettit was saying, our intention is for an open access carrier neutral network, so we can support the Oregon broadband connectivity through our anchor tenants. So what we're looking at is the option to having more anchor tenants from even what we were talking about with the state and higher ed. And since we have that ability to amortize our fiber investments over 20 years, we actually can support a longer return on investment that's more financially viable for the rural telecoms to expand those services. So currently, the telecoms need about a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years at the most to have to do a return on investment. If they have one entity that is asking for connectivity, it is not financially viable for those telecoms to lay fiber. So as a result, those communities are out of luck. That school is out of luck. As we look, and we have been doing this already, is we're not only looking at state sites, but our other community partners, community health institutions, libraries, schools, tribes. We can now actually start seeing where economies of scale start building, and then we can extend and leverage those connections. With the public-private partnerships, we recognize that there are telecoms that would be better positioned to provide that more direct service or that last mile, and we want to leverage our collective strengths and assets to better connect across the state to improve our network architecture. We've been very much just in a very reactionary mode with our network architecture and paying a lot for our network, but we feel like we can improve and optimize our network for the state of for the whole state. After our testimony on Wednesday at the House Economic Development and Trade Committee, we did hear back from the Telecommunications Association. They did express some concerns. We've been working on Amendment 5. I think it's now maybe Amendment 8 to address their concerns, because we really do want to make sure that we're not in direct competition with those middle mile providers. We aren't, as Dr. Pettit was saying, interested in overbuilding our network. In fact, we're interested in optimizing our investments and truly about being smarter about how we architect our network. So these amendments are still in hearing at the House Economic Development and Trade Committee. The intent of our amendments is for expanding connectivity across the state, and we believe that collaboration is key. With that said, we are proceeding with lighting up our fiber routes and our partnership with higher education based upon those 640 sites that Alex talked about. We have started putting together our roadmap, our project plan, and our governance structure. And over the next 6 months, we'll be finalizing those design plans. We felt it was necessary at this point to ask for that scope and clarification, given our limitations in statute today. This bill, 4023, and those amendments help us identify our systems boundary or our network boundary. Thank you for your time. Is there any other follow-up questions?
Thank you. And now we're going to move to the third of three sections.
We are.
Right?
Yes. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, the last section that we have today is focused on information security, the implementation of Senate Bill 90. We have at the dais, of course, Dr. Pettit. Stefan, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Stefan Richards. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Oregon. We got kind of two parts, the Senate Bill 90, and it's interesting we see the EO, but I had two parts of Senate Bill 90. I'm going to speak primarily for just a few minutes about what we're doing to unify information security within the state across the executive branch, the first part of Senate Bill 90. And then I'm going to invite a couple of our chair and vice chair of our Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Committee up to talk a bit about what the committee is doing, since they're the primary runners of the committee, and we are staff to their committee at this point. So, and they'll talk about what we're doing to get ready for the deliverable that we've been given by the legislature for January of next year about a plan for a cybersecurity center of excellence. So with that, this slide hasn't changed, and there's a lot of words on this slide. It's a huge strategy, and really the things that I would point to is really four primary pillars that we're trying to address across the state. And they're very difficult. They're sort of squishy, so they're not primarily all technical. But the first is really aligning the state to a risk-driven approach for security. So we will never have enough resources to completely eliminate the security risks across the state. So the goal is to make sure the activities that we're following are following the highest risks of the state first. And so we're looking across agencies, across technologies, and across all the assets in the state to make sure that the investments are being made in the riskiest places first. And that's a process where we're applying locally within agencies as well as across the enterprise. The biggest thing that we're trying as a thrust is to get some solid governance across the enterprise leadership team, ELT, about a place that we can make decisions as a whole, but then also have local help for agencies to make their own localized decisions about the risks that they're going to take that may not affect the entire enterprise. The second is a culture of security, which is not just the annual training that we had under the executive order, but really trying to get education to all the parts of the state relevant to the roles that each individual has. So this is helping the governor's office understand their role, helping you all understand the role that of the legislature and of the fiscal office, as well as agency directors, CIOs, and even individuals maybe that don't have IT careers. The resilient IT architecture pillar is really about making sure the technology is defensible. In a lot of ways, we've built a very highly complex set of technology in that we build everything locally. This is looking for the opportunities where we could maybe simplify architecture and find ways that are more securable for less resources. Mm-hmm. And then finally, which is found in a number of different risk assessments that have been done externally by about the state, focusing very heavily on finding the bad things that get into our borders quickly and having a very robust response capability that gets us back on our feet quickly. That's that last pillar. So with that, with all those words, really the big things we're working on this biennium is really my big three, which is unifying the team. We moved quite a few resources from agencies into the Enterprise Security Office in order to resource all those things I just said. That's really been the first and foremost, and that's what we've, I'll talk a little bit about what we've been spending our time on, but that's really what's been in front of us immediately. In addition to that, though, trying to establish that risk governance, because it really hasn't been here before. We kind of make our decisions a little bit based on what maybe was in the paper most recently or what got broken into most recently or based on a project rather than looking at things holistically. And then finally, really looking at that incident response capability and recovery capability, because we found over and over and over again in agency assessments that is one of the number one areas that's most risky to the state. We just don't have a good capability consistently across agencies. So what we finished through the end of 2017, which brings me to what we're working on now, through 2017, we worked on moving the staff, the actual mechanics of moving the positions, making sure that folks found chairs in the Enterprise Security Office, knew what their role was. And so as of January 1st, all affected positions are now part of DAS. They're on the HR roles, and all affected individuals are working with us at least part-time. The reason not full-time is we're trying to make sure we don't reduce any capabilities inside of an agency. And so there's about 15 individuals that are directly affected. Most of them are not 100% cut. They're about maybe say half and half at this point, with a goal of by the middle of this coming year, we've worked this with agency leadership, that we'll have them completely phased over. So that's been the biggest move, along with making sure we've got a solid strategy laid out for how we're going to do the rest of the biennium. Where we are right now, and you see that square there, first of all, we're trying to take the services that we already had and build them into something that truly we can apply across the state with a solid sort of service level agreement. And that includes all of the services of the folks that we brought in as they're relevant to being done from an enterprise shop. And so it's important to talk a little bit about what I mean by that. There are some things that you absolutely have to do. You have to do locally because they require local context, like making a business decision about, for example, I'm doing an HR investigation of an individual, and I'm looking at their email and trying to decide, did they violate our agency's acceptable use policy? Well, that's not really a good service for the Enterprise Security Office to provide. But a great service that we should be providing is, have I made a good decision about how I'm securing my network, let's say, and have I made good technology investments in the security technologies? And so we're building those services and trying to very carefully identify what are the things the agencies need to do and what are the things that the Enterprise Security Office absolutely is going to do as a service. And so that's what we're working on right now, and staffing to that. That's along with that, taking the services we already provided, like vulnerability management, and making sure everybody is consistently using those services, and that they're sort of a full, a full service level agreement rather than they've kind of built organically. I want to run them like a service, just like you would go to a third party provider, where there's a service level agreement and expectation of delivery of service. And we're also, with those 35 positions that came over, over half of them are empty. So we are focusing very heavily on filling positions. So that's probably the biggest thing. Now that we've got them defined, we know what the organization needs to be, we're really focused on finding really good people, bringing them into the state.
Were they vacant at the agency?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Through the transition, a number of positions were vacated before they transferred over. So in some cases, they were vacant when they were identified. In other cases, individuals were moved to other parts of their agency, and they came over as vacancies for us to fill.
No.
No. Much better.
The short answer is no.
Thank you.
They were vacated as part of this process, Madam Chair. And so the agency,
most of them,
many of them were held back by the agency. And so the direct answer to your question, Madam Chair, is no.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you.
All right. So thank you. So looking at the, I'm not really, unless there's a lot of questions about the further plans, I mean, really, if we look at the rest, the balance of 2018, we're trying to establish new services, really building our SOC capability, our response capability, going all the way down to the agencies rather than just being a state-driven one, enterprise-driven one that we have today, and really focusing on application security, which is where the majority of our breaches have been in the time I've been here. And the most importantly, the beginning of this year, I wanted to find the metrics that we're going to be using across the state and getting those, finding the methods to collect them. And by the end of the year, be regularly reporting those. And I would expect that those would be driving the annual reports that we would be doing to legislature as well. The same metrics we'd be reporting to the governor's office, to agency directors. We would have enterprise level metrics for the legislature in that time frame. And so then, and then finally, our final, you know, as we end up the biennium, we're really looking at how are we doing, and we're looking for third-party alignment. Have we staffed the right things, taken on the right things? Is our risk-driven approach right? And then also looking internally, are we providing good service across the state? Have we, you know, fallen into any holes in the process of transition? So that's sort of the execution summary. While we've been doing all that, we've continued on our most successful program, which has been vulnerability management. I show this graph with a few major checkpoints, which have to do with either biennial boundaries or when we've been here last. And when we were here last in December, we were at about two critical vulnerabilities per thing on the network, per any device that responds on the network. We're down to just over one, which our goal was to try and get the whole network, all devices, under 1.0. If you look to the beginning of the biennium, we've cut the number in half. I click forward here. That's while still adding just a few hosts and keeping all the same agencies in our inside of our program. So we're actually continuing to grow the program, but most of the effort's been in driving that number down, and we've actually cut the number in half. If you look all the way back to when the executive order was filed, we've almost reduced it by two-thirds. What I also would point out, that last column or last row that I added there, we now have 13 agencies that are below the 1.0 number that we've focused on. So as an enterprise, we're at 1.25, but we have 13 agencies that have already come below the line and stay consistently below the line. I want to give a few, this is, getting these vulnerabilities removed is not just a security thing. It requires IT, business leaders. It's a majorly hard thing to do. And so I want to make sure I gave some credit that this is not just the Enterprise Security Office doing this work. The first five agencies we've had that have met both our requirements, not just for the vulnerabilities, but also the quality of the scans, meaning how they're getting everything in their network and we're getting deep scans. These five agencies were the first ones to achieve that. So they're really leading the pack, and I want to make sure they got credit for that. Our biggest improvement, OHA DHS, some of their early numbers at points were as high as 8 criticals per host. They are now right at about 1 critical per host, just about to trip over to the boundary of meeting the requirements. Given the size of that agency and the number of hosts, we're talking 16,000 some devices that are attached to the network that were involved. It's a huge undertaking. So I really want to make sure they're getting recognized. And then our two lowest vulnerabilities per host, I think I've previously said this, PERS has continued to stay for the critical vulnerabilities, one of the lowest. And when I say low, this is like 0.03 vulnerabilities per host, so basically almost indistinguishable from zero. And the Department of Veterans Affairs as well, they're actually the lowest at, I think, 0.01 currently, meaning they basically don't have any critical vulnerabilities in their environment. This as we continue to move this program, this is only the worst of the worst that we're trying to get rid of. As we get more and more agencies under this line, we will likely start to move this metric to actually include the high level of vulnerabilities. So this is just the super critical stuff, the stuff that we know attackers know how to attack and are actually actively attacking.
If I could interrupt for just a minute, and it's actually kind of a question. When was the last breach we worked?
So the last, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, the last breach that we worked was, I have to make sure that would have been probably the Department of Environmental Quality, which would have been about 7 months ago.
Whereas we were averaging about one every 2 months coming into this.
Yes.
So if I'm looking at the numbers right, first I want to say, I don't even want to pretend to appear to understand what counts as a vulnerability. And you shouldn't tell us, right? but it's bad. It's
right.
Something bad.
This is the reduction of bad things, ma'am.
Right. When I think about the conversation we were having in the Legislative Audits Committee this week and performance measurement, this is all that sort of good news stuff you want to see, where the agency participation has about doubled, the devices inventoried is close to being doubled, the vulnerabilities is reduced to less than half. This is remarkable if you just think about it that way.
Representative Nathanson. Yes, that's exactly why we wanted to present it, because I think it's a bit of good news. The act of measuring it and reporting it to the directors and their CIOs costs a lot of action in agencies, and that's why the metrics in other areas are so critical to moving the program forward. That's why I've put that front center in this year's work. And I hope to have other good news, measurable good news, where we can set a benchmark and show the improvement in quantifiable terms. That's why I know that defining what that metric is kind of hard, but if you measure it as bad things, yes, I would say we've instrumented more places looking for bad things, and we've reduced the number by about a half while we've been increasing that.
Or more.
Yeah. So with that, I'm going to sort of take a pause and say that this is most of what I wanted to cover as far as what we've done in the executive branch to unify at this point. And I wanted to take any questions before I ask the chairs of our advisory committee to come up and talk about what we've done outside of the executive branch.
We'll start the questions with Senator Linthicum.
I don't really have a question. Great presentation. This is just a thought that struck me as you're going through giving kudos to these organizations and these people. One of the very first slides, I have it here, slide 21, you started talking about these four columns, and I would suggest the culture of security ought to be the start. The culture of security, that the inner ring, the second perimeter idea of personnel and training and whatever, leads to the holistic, proactive management, and then you have resilient IT technicals, jazz, and whatnot.
Yes.
But the culture is where you start the ball rolling, and that's where people become your most valuable players. And that's just my thought about your graphics and how you present that and how you train your own staff and department staff.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, as the chair and vice chair of the advisory council come up, just wanted to point out the growth in resources that have been applied to the Enterprise Security Office and cybersecurity across the state. Centrally, when this topic began to gain a lot of highlight, the Enterprise Security Office within the Office of the State CIO had somewhere between 5 and 7 FTE. Subsequently, the office was grown to 12 FTE, then to 24. Now I think the office with the unification is nearly 60 FTE, I think 58, 59, something like that. And so certainly a lot of resources are being applied. Now they're being properly coordinated and deployed, and you're seeing some of the results of that.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for having us. And
introduce yourself.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not used to this. I run a business. My name is Carrie Fry. I'm president of Red Hawk Network Security and the chair of the Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Council.
And I'm Charlie Kawasaki. I'm vice chair of the Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Council, also CTO for PacStar, as well as board member for the Technology Association of Oregon and the co-founder and manager of the Northwest Cyber Camp.
Perfect. Thank you for having us today. I want to give you a very brief update on the council and where we are and what we've been up to. We have 9 voting members, and we have spent the last several months really trying to create cohesive structure around how we operate, what we're doing, going back to Senate Bill 90 and really focusing on the 5 purposes of the council. Ensuring that we're meeting each of those, as well as working to develop the structure for the Cybersecurity Center for Excellence that we will recommend to the state CIO office. During this time, we've put together basically 2 committees, a technical services committee, which is looking at developing what those services might look like that the CCOE will at one point provide. And then we've also built a framework committee, which is the committee which will develop the framework, recommended framework and structure of the CCOE funding opportunities where we might gain insight from other organizations that or what other states have done and adopt some of those same measures. Part of the second purpose of in SB 90 of the committee is to provide a statewide forum for discussing and resolving cybersecurity issues. In meeting that, we have created we have partnered with different organizations in 4 events and developed the in bringing together the cybersecurity policy committees, and in that we'll work to bring the vendor community together, bring the community of cybersecurity together to, in essence, to create more collaboration, bring together ideas, and also to leverage the resources that the community has out there. Those 4 events will take place. We've got one coming up in March, partnering with Technology Association of Oregon. We've got the Oregon Cybersecurity Day, partnering with University of Oregon in Eugene, partnering with Northwest Cyber Camps in July, and then finally, and those both will be in Portland, or that one will be in Portland, and then the final one will be in November, partnering with the Cybersecurity Education Summit in Central Oregon in Bend. Additionally, the Cyber Oregon website has launched, and we've had over 2,000 page views in the last 30 days, 452 unique users, and 716 different sessions. So those that are hitting the website are visiting more than just a single page. Most of the traffic is driven from media and social activity. And one interesting point is that a majority of the traffic that is hitting the website is coming from desktops, which is an indicator that people are hitting the website from their office or work location. And next, Charlie's going to spend some time reviewing the report that was presented to the Cybersecurity Advisory Council back in December and January from Portland State University's Center for Public Service.
Thank you, Carrie. So before getting started, I should recognize Rebecca Craven, who is here as the manager and the leader from PSU's Center for Public Service, who conducted this report and the research project last fall under the request from the Oregon State CIO's office and the Cybersecurity Advisory Council. They did a fantastic job with the goal of helping inform us what the real needs are and the real resources that we might bring to bear in order to address some of these needs, rather than simply getting a bunch of people together and guessing. So we conducted a very thorough analysis across the state, conducting both surveys, focus groups, comparative analysis for what other states are doing, as well as looking at some of the resources within the state that we think that we can bring to bear on these problems, so that we can match them all up and make sure that, you know, we're proposing a center of excellence and a set of services that we can realistically do with the resources at hand. So the Center for Public Service delivered a 180-page report, not including tremendous statistical appendices, so I won't drag you through all of those. I would like to just point out a few very brief highlights on some of the findings. As part of the survey, they surveyed 205 respondents. I'm pleased to say they represented a very broad cross-section of the stakeholders within the state. So that included rural and metro area organizations, public and private sector, and representatives from many different vertical industries, agriculture, medical, healthcare, tech, things like that. And we did see very consistent feedback to the survey and our activities. And one of the things that stood out, and it shouldn't be a significant surprise because it is bullet number 5, I think, on the Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Council's agenda, is to enhance and promote workforce development initiatives in the cybersecurity space. And that came back loud and clear through several different pieces of feedback. One is that in the survey findings, the organizations all said they expected to have increasing cybersecurity needs forecast out in the future. As a matter of fact, 90% of respondents said they believed they had increasing cybersecurity needs. And more than just shy of 60% had reported either extreme, very difficult, or difficulty in finding trained cybersecurity professionals to help them meet those needs. So I think that just echoes the reason why SB 90 was passed and the key agenda for the Oregon Cybersecurity Advisory Council in terms of that initiative. Next slide. Thank you. Another piece of the survey that we put together had to do with the kinds of technical services that a center of excellence could potentially provide. We wanted to basically put some straw proposals out on the table and see what kinds of services organizations would be interested in. That spanned prevention and education, monitoring, assistance with incident response and cybercrime response. And the good news is, my takeaway from it is, it was very strong response that there was a high level of interest from the kinds of services that one might imagine coming from a CCOE. I think the downside is there was strong interest in everything that we came up with, and we're going to need to prioritize, and that's not going to be a trivial task given the magnitude of the need, combined with an unclear roadmap yet for exactly how we're going to put all these programs together. But as you can see from the slide, just some of the examples on the prevention side and the education side, we very uniformly had more than half the respondents saying they were highly interested in educational type of offerings, early alert systems, assistance with helping them secure their own networks. So there were a lot of different very strong indicators for that. Another thing we did to sort of cross-validate our findings on the survey was that we did focus groups around the state. And Rebecca, how many different locations did you visit? So 4 different locations, 8 groups, and that's much more of a qualitative piece of feedback rather than a quantitative piece of feedback. And again, though, workforce development really popped out as a very high agenda item. One thing that popped out that was interesting was a lot of discussion around K-12, which is something that we didn't anticipate quite as strongly, but participants saying that they thought that was an important piece of the educational initiative. So another thing that we did was we did a survey for where the cybersecurity resources were in the state, and it should be no surprise that the vast majority of the resources, whether they're educational programs, consulting companies, cybersecurity companies, they all focused heavily around the metropolitan areas, as you might expect, and that the rural areas were highly underserved. And one of the key takeaways here is as we work on our workforce development activities, we need to take that into account and really think about how we can serve some of those outlying regions. I think we have one more slide. The key findings for the initial report were, first of all, of course, we need to figure out what the legal structure for a CCOE is and figure out how that works and what kind of services it can provide. That's a task for recommending from the Advisory Council. Recommendation that came back was figuring out how to bring more expertise into the council around pursuing outside funding sources, particularly the Center for Public Service identified a number of federal grants, particularly from NSF. Also, we identified a number of sources from the comparative analysis of the other state programs coming from DHS, Department of Homeland Security, that we'd like to look at pretty strongly in order to figure out how to bolster these things so it's not a small group of just volunteers trying to solve the state's problem. And so that was a key piece of finding from the CPS. Another recommendation was to expand the size of the stakeholders in the advisory committee. We don't suspect that that's going to be a formal voting expansion of the voting members so much as it is anointing some kind of associate board member position so that we can get much more representation from a lot more stakeholders and make that more formal. And focus on workforce development, not a surprise there. One of the things that Carrie didn't mention is we have another committee. It's our educational committee. It's one of the professors at Oregon Tech who is leading that committee, but really has his heart in the right place. And he's reaching out to the rest of the higher ed community to figure out what is the right recommendation to make in terms of workforce development. And we're pretty pleased with some of the early thoughts that they have in terms of that direction. Last but not least, there is a lot of very interesting projects going on in other states that we believe we need to learn from and learn from best practices. And in addition to that, there may be some opportunities to partner with some other states to leverage some of the work that they're actually doing so that we're not just reinventing new programs that they've already built. In some cases, some of the states have received funding from Department of Homeland Security to build national centers that have a mandate to serve the entire nation. And where we can leverage existing programs and resources, we would certainly like to do that and not have to reproduce those programs. So that's some of the key findings that we're using to then take next steps to build the plan.
Chair Nathanson and the committee, are there any questions?
Questions? Yes.
I don't have a real good question to ask, so I'll let you kind of cash it out. I'm curious about workforce development and the potential or the pathway that includes artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, self-learning, artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever you want to call that, and I realize you're just getting going here, but I'm wondering if the technical training in workforce is guys understanding and mucking with router technology and TCP/IP and whatnot, or is it on the artificial intelligence side, a whole gamut, or do you have a focus or a feel for unfortunately, the time frames are going to move faster and faster, so you guys have to be on your toes, not me. And I hate to make fun of it like that, but I'm just curious if you can, kind of put some boundaries around that for us.
Well, one of the things that, Representative Nathan, members of the committee, thank you for the question. One of the things Charlie and I have talked about is workforce development actually really starts with K-12, and the innovation that comes out of the young K-12 kids, for instance, will continue to drive AI, will continue to drive the automation and innovation that comes out of this into cybersecurity. We are definitely wanting to partner with all of the education components within the higher education service area. So I think putting confines on that, we'll need to structure that in a way that says these are the types of services we need to provide now, but innovation will have to be a major component of that. Charlie, do you want to chime in?
I would a little also to clarify the kind of workforce development that we're talking about, because there are very different needs for different organizations, and I'll lump them into two camps. One are the needs for the cybersecurity product companies, those companies that are developing innovative technical solutions to cybersecurity problems. And in the case of machine learning, I believe it's sort of at a state of the industry where it makes most sense to encourage research from organizations like OSU and higher ed collaborating with technology companies to develop new technologies. Workforce development also, however, in terms of raw numbers of needed people, I would argue the numbers are needed in what you might think of more along the lines of cybersecurity practitioners, like the kinds of professionals that Stefan would need to hire to make sure that the systems are secure and they follow best practices and are configured properly. And so when you look at those needs, you know, it might be a 10-to-1 in terms of the kinds of people that we need to train, people who you would think of more as vocational or type training as opposed to research type training. And we do need to address both needs, but the unit volume right now, I believe, is on that vocational side.
That is a great answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. To Ms. Fry and Mr. Kawasaki, thank you for being at the Capitol. We've seen some of you before. I hope that this experience testifying in committee wasn't too awful. There are committee hearings happening in other rooms that are really much more intense. But thank you very much for the information, for your participation, and what you're doing to help Oregonians. And to the Office of the State CIO, thank you for an excellent presentation today. And I have to say, especially from me individually, I particularly liked some of the graphic representations of financial data and the maps especially. So thank you. Really good job. There's no other business before us, is there?
No. Chair Nathanson, okay. We're all done for today.
With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.